I got a letter from the government the other day. I opened and read it and burned that. Man, it's the way that I live, no concern that. Man, we don't have to settle this another way. A letter from the government the other day. I opened and read it and burned that. Man, it's the way that I live, no concern that. Man, we don't have to settle this another way.
Movement, music, move into it. Put a fist up, prove it to us. This is much more than music to us. This is beauty and strength. And if you know about the music, then you know about life. This is movement, music, move into it. Put a fist up, prove it to us. This is much more than music to us. This is beauty and strength. And if you know about the music, then you know about life.
Word is
any kind of activity that takes place on the floor of the Congress or the Senate.
Good morning. You are listening to Your World News here on 1480 AM WEAC Radio WPWC. My name is Naveed Nasser. With me today is my co-host, Solomon Kamishong. He wasn't able to make it last week, but he's back today. And Solomon, are you there?
Yes, I am. I'm here.
Excellent. Excellent. So I'm sure you got a chance to listen to last week's show. The guest was Kwasi Satu from the Criminal Injustice Committee. We talked about a lot of things that are going on both locally and nationally with regards to the prison system and the criminalization of black and brown youth in the U.S. And we were thinking maybe internationalizing the scope of it a little bit this week, but also continuing the discussion about Trayvon Martin and what's going on locally with regards to prisons and the criminal justice system. So, Solomon, can you start us off this week?
Yeah, and first and foremost, I thought the interview with that you conducted with Kwasi was right on point. It was excellent. It's hard-hitting, and it's just the kind of stuff that, the corporate media shies away from, deliberately. So, kudos to you and Kwasi for that. Excellent, interview or dialogue. I'd love to start us off today, and I think that you laid the foundation really well in terms of looking at the need to look at Trayvon Martin, the deaths of so many others. Trayvon Martin, just happened to be killed by a wannabe cop, but when we start to look at all the other brothers and sisters of color who have been, shot down unarmed by the police, such as the 7-year-old girl Ayanna Stanley Jones in 2010, Trey Joyner here in D.C., Delonte Rollins, a 14-year-old black boy who was shot in the back, by undercover cops. It goes on and on and on, and I think that we need to connect the dots to the international scope, as you said, because these things that are going on domestically, Naveed, we talk about this a lot on air and off air.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that so many Americans are just so apathetic, and the real work needs to be done, like right now, consistently. You've been doing that work. I've been doing that work. So many other folks have been doing that work. But we need to, expand this. We need to use, these rallies as points of departure to propel ourselves into some really, aggressive, consistent, community-focused work, teach-ins, legal work, international and domestic legal work, to prevent Trayvon Martins, to prevent Ayanna Stanley Jones from happening, but also to prevent, young brothers and sisters who are in Afghanistan, who are in Iraq. God forbid there's any kind of war in Iran, but, this work needs to be done so that we can prevent any kind of war, any kind of bombing campaign or otherwise in Iran, because those young people that have been killed by Apache helicopters, by night raids, by just blatant massacres, by way of Sergeant Robert Bales and his accomplices, is not a novel thing. This has been going on. We can go back to the Vietnam War. This was done routinely, and not just at the My Lai massacre. But we need to connect, look at these young people the same way we look at Trayvon Martin. These are innocent, impressionable, vulnerable lives of children who have had the life ripped away from their bodies. But instead, and I'll end on this, Instead of it being, you know, somebody like George Zimmerman, you know, it's trained, you know, killers by way of U.S. military who have been many of which who have been brainwashed through propaganda and turned into, you know, almost like rabid dogs and just, you know, just go in there, just bomb them. Those little specks on the ground, just drop the missiles from the helicopters, drop the missiles from the F-16, you know, fighter jets.
Right.
And so, you know, I'm glad that we're going to be expanding this this dialogue to cover, to connect the dots to what's going on internationally, to, you know, what has been going on domestically for quite some time, Naveed.
Well, yeah, and when we talk about making this dialogue, internationalizing it or what have you, what we need to address, and I think we talked about this before, at least privately, maybe not on the air, but one of the things that needs to be addressed is the close affinity between a lot of police officers and police departments and the U.S. military. In other words, a lot of these guys get their training in the U.S. military, in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and they come back here, they have that same mentality, and they go to work in these communities, and they treat those communities essentially like occupied territory and the populations as enemies. And that really needs to be addressed. A lot of them also end up going to work in the penitentiary system, in the prison industrial complex.
Got it.
And what goes on in Gitmo, like we know about it, what goes on in Gitmo, we know what goes on in Bagram, we know what goes on in Abu Ghraib, we've seen the pictures, but what we haven't seen a lot of times are the pictures of what goes on in prisons right here in the U.S., and in many cases it's much the same thing, maybe even worse in a lot of cases, but frequently that goes unseen and unheard, and a lot of people either don't want to talk about it or they're fine with it. They're fine with it, and they may not even say it, but they're fine with it because they genuinely believe in their heart of hearts that those people wouldn't be where they are if they didn't deserve it, if they hadn't done something horrible, and that needs to be addressed. That needs to be addressed, the fact that the same situations, the same things that we see in places like Gitmo and in some of these notorious names now of these sites that are all over the globe, happen right here in the U.S., but it's a routine, everyday sort of thing, a routine, everyday brutality and dehumanization that happens within the confines of the prison industrial complex, and it goes, by and large, it goes unchallenged, it goes, people don't care much about it, there's a lack of investigative reporting, really, into what's going on, and, you know, frankly, like I said, a lot of people are okay with it. I've listened to talk shows where this has been the subject of discussion, not talk shows like this, but other talk shows, where people have called in and essentially said, "I'm glad that this is happening. Those people deserve it, and they deserve even worse."
Yeah.
That definitely needs to be addressed as part of this internationalizing the scope of what's going on with the criminal injustice system, tying it into war, tying it into the military-industrial complex. Really, when we talk about the military-industrial complex and the prison-industrial complex, we're talking about two wings of the same bird here. We need to start thinking about this issue, these problems, in a systematic way and addressing them in a systematic way. And until we do that, we're going to be running around reacting to every individual incident that happens. Salman, I'd love to hear your take on what I just said.
Yeah, and I caught my mind's eye, but, you know, what you just said, the very last words that you uttered, you know, to paraphrase it, I mean, you're alluding to, you know, reactionaries, you know, that many of us have turned into a whole, you know, wide lot of reactionaries where we're just, you know, some of us know that racism and the institutional racism and white supremacy exist in the U.S., that masses of injustices exist in the U.S., racially, socioeconomically, and many other ways, gender-wise, you know, mass sexism and misogyny, but we just kind of wait for these things to happen and say, oh, when it does happen, we're going to go out there and rally. We're going to go out there and march. And the rallies are important. They're important role. They have an important role to play in terms of raising the specter of consciousness. You know, rallies, that to me, that's the way I see rallies. But in terms of the political work, you know, in terms of changing policies, revamping systems, altering systems, knocking them off of their so-called rockers, you know, that kind of work, you know, comes out of the rallies or the teach-ins or the forums and so forth, where the specter of consciousness has been raised on a collective level. But, you know, what we routinely see is, you know, whether it's Oscar Grant or Sean Bell or Adolf Grimes, you know, we just go on and on and on. You know, we see just kind of like a procession of rallies, and certainly not everybody that goes to these rallies is a reactionary. I know some, just like you do, I know some unbelievable people from Oakland to D.C. and everywhere in between that continue to do this work. But their work needs to be supported. They do work consistently, week in, week out, and I have the utmost respect for them. But by and large, they are a minority of activists, and their work needs to be metastasized in a positive way. People need to jump on that stuff. But as you said, it's you know, we've become reactionaries. We just wait for this, and I've just seen some sick things with the hoodie thing. People capitalizing, like literally capitalizing, you know, financially from this hoodie thing and promoting parties and certainly not everyone that goes to these rallies is doing that, but folks, you know, they go to rallies and they go home kind of feeling that, you know, good, that they've accomplished something. No, that's just the tip of the iceberg. The real work starts the days and weeks and months and years after the rallies. That's the consistent work that has to come. And I'll, you know, I'll end on this. You also mentioned, Naveed, you mentioned the apathy and people being apathetic and even beyond that, people just being, you know, just cold-blooded, you know, just... I would say just vile. You know, I've heard some talk shows, people, like you said, you know, going back to the invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq, people calling in to shows saying that, you know, these people, they're all terrorists and they need to, you know, their countries need to be just carpet bombed. They need to be turned into parking lots, you know, which in other words means, you know, just bomb the whole thing. And these aren't necessarily just like these right wing fringe, you know, folks that we see that we see in our heads as these like white supremacists. No, some of these folks are folks that come from communities, you know, that you and I come from, and they were bloodthirsty based on the propaganda that was fed to them immediately after 9/11. That yeah, it's the Muslims, you know, look at them, it's the Muslims, and I think that's just sick in a number of ways when you have people that come from oppressed communities who should know better that are now, you know, asking for the same thing that these white, right-wing, white supremacists have been asking for. But that's the psychology, I guess, of oppression, that oftentimes the oppressed, if their minds are not strong enough, if there is no intervention along the way, that their minds become shaped by the oppressor themselves, and they start to take upon the images and forced assimilation into you know, the mores, the, or, you know, or the lack thereof, you know, from these from the oppressor. So I think it's right on point that this dialogue that we are having on this show right now, and that we're going to continue to have on this show, and for all intents and purposes, I'm sure that we're going to revisit this many times, needs to be expanded into teach-ins and community forums, long community forums that are based around participation, people chiming in and folks being there to be able to have those teachable moments to reel people in and to connect the dots that, you know this the young brother in Kabul, you know, named Mohammed, you know, who had his life taken away, you know, by way of a drone strike. How is he so much different than Trayvon Martin? Their similarities are abound. They both had their lives taken and ripped away from them, from their young bodies. Through just indiscriminate violence. Mm-hmm. that violence that sees no boundaries, and violence that also actually happens to be discriminatory, mm-hmm. Is inflicted upon people of color and inflicted upon those who are non-white Christians, those who are Muslim. Their lives are expendable, and Naveed, their lives are, when their lives are taken, we're just going to call it collateral damage, and we're going to give those families $50,000. Those families that lost that not just lost loved ones, had loved ones stolen away from them by way of murderous rampages done by U.S. military personnel. $50,000. That'll be enough. Yeah, that'll be enough. You can do that, and that's enough. Just go on. That's supposed to be justice. Mm-hmm. So.
Right. Well, Psalm, we got to go to a quick break right now. When we come back, we're going to have our special guest with us right here on Your World News on WEAC Radio 1480 AM. So we'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
Listening to WPWC WEAC Radio, 1480 AM, WEACradio.com.
My name is Joe Thompson. I'm 29 years old and have a career that I love as a systems analyst. Career. It still sounds cool to say that word. I never could have gotten on this path without a college degree. And if the college me were here, he'd tell you.
I never would have gotten to college without big brothers, big sisters. I could have ended up anywhere. On the streets even. But college? Joe Thompson? Not likely. My big brother helped me out. He taught me I could do anything. At a time when a lot of people were saying just the opposite.
And to a 7-year-old, that means a lot. My big brother's name is Phil. And Phil is the reason that this 7-year-old grows up to be a systems analyst.
Whether you donate money or time, you're helping big brothers, big sisters help a child. And that can last a lifetime. Start something today at BigBrothersBigSisters.org. Brought to you by Big Brothers Big Sisters and the Ad Council.
Hey, Action News is proud to be sponsored by Healthcare for America Now. HCAN is a national coalition of more than 1,000 groups in 50 states, representing 30 million people. HCAN works to promote, defend, implement, and improve the Affordable Care Act at both the state and federal levels. They also try to protect Medicare and Medicaid, increase corporate accountability, and confront forces that seek to take away critical services. HCAN believes in creating jobs, not cutting programs people depend on. HCAN runs comprehensive issue campaigns that mobilize people at the grassroots and define the public debate. HCAN is fighting to protect, implement, and improve the new health care law through national and state-based legislative and regulatory campaigns built on grassroots action, public education, communications, policy analysis, and groundbreaking research. HCAN has become a respected voice and national leader on healthcare while continuing to focus on aggressive field activity. Support HCAN, Healthcare for America Now.
You're listening to WPWC WEAC Radio, 1480 AM, WEACradio.com.
Listening to Your World News here on 1480 AM WEAC Radio, WPWC. With me is my co-host Solomon Kamishong. I'm Naveed Nasser. Solomon, I understand we have a special guest with us today. Would you like to go ahead and introduce him?
Yes, special guest is a very, very, very good friend of mine. He's also even better friend to Justice, and he's one of those educators that it is very novel, in American educational centers. And his name is Dr. Joseph Richardson, and he's a professor in the African American Studies Department at the University of Maryland, but has his particular focus is in carceral studies, the prison industrial complex, and a range of other things, you know, connected to the so-called justice system in America. But he gets out into the community. He takes his students to visit, you know, places like Ward 7 and Ward 8 in Washington, D.C., so they know that the prison industrial complex doesn't start in prison. It, you know, the plan to have a pipeline of black and brown people sent to prisons across America starts in the government neglected communities from which these people come from, and shows, you know, these students the scope, and they have to do a lot of ethnographic studies. And he also, along with myself, helped, was one of the founders of a prison-to-college pipeline program that we started at the University of Maryland a number of years ago, where we went with students on Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays into Oak Hill Juvenile Detention Center, now known as the New Beginnings Detention Center, and did a range of workshops there, and then we also had a reentry program. So it's a pleasure to have him on the show. I know you've met him a number of times, Naveed,
mm-hmm.
and so it's great to have him on the show and for us to talk about the prison industrial complex, but also to talk about justice, and he has a lot of things to say about Trayvon Martin and police brutality in this country as well, as he's done a number of studies and papers around that topic.
How you brothers doing?
How you doing, Joe?
Good. So I just want to, before we get into the conversation, and for anyone that's listening, I just want to express my sincere condolences to Trayvon Martin's family and his friends and all of those who knew him. But I guess the first thing that I really want to address is the issue, kind of the sensationalizing of the Trayvon Martin case. I think Solomon had brought this up before the break, and that we're seeing a lot of hoodie marches and the symbolisms of people who are now kind of jumping on this case and how much it means to people, and it sparked this real debate about what it means to be an young African-American male in this country. But I guess I'm just a little bit kind of disturbed by the fact that we've had, and as it's been mentioned before, we've had numerous, countless incidents where African-American men have been brutally kind of gunned down by the police or by just normal citizens. I think during the same week that Trayvon Martin, or within the weeks after Trayvon Martin's death, there was also a case in Mississippi where I think three or four young white men were actually sentenced to prison for dragging and running over a black male in Mississippi. And we've had numerous other cases which have been mentioned before, such as Oscar Grant. We just recently had the Romarley Graham case in New York, where police officers literally ran into someone's house without a search warrant, ran into this young man's bathroom after pursuing him for what they allegedly believed they saw, a buy and bust of marijuana, and shot him in the bathroom of his grandmother's home without a search warrant. So these kind of cases have been going on with minimal national attention, and many people probably don't even know about these cases because we've been so kind of inundated with these issues surrounding Trayvon Martin. And I don't want to devalue or belittle his case at all, and I think it's a starting point for us to have a larger discussion about the laws that are now on the books, particularly Stand Your Ground laws. And as many of you know, those laws are kind of on the books in 20 states, but since those laws have been enacted since 2005, justifiable homicides have almost quadrupled in Florida, and justifiable homicides across the nation where those laws exist has gone up at least 54%. So I think we need to also, while we're talking about this case, is not to forget that the Stand Your Ground laws was actually a law pushed by the NRA. And the NRA over the dissent from law enforcement that the law shouldn't actually be on the books still had the pressure and the political capital to convince legislators to put those laws on the books in almost half of the states in our country. So while we're talking about Trayvon Martin, there are some other pressing issues which we need to think about how the NRA and lobbyist groups such as the NRA managed to pressure and convince and persuade greedy politicians to serve their best interests. So I don't want us to get detracted from the larger issues of what are the policies which actually exist in America, which kind of support and condone the assassinations of young men like Trayvon Martin across this country.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And you know, also to mention, you know, I'm glad you mentioned the NRA, Dr. Richardson. And in that same vein, you know, we also need to look at the American Legislative Exchange Council, otherwise known as ALEC, you know, because they've been behind, they've been behind that same law and other, you know, nefarious laws in this country that support the prison industrial complex. And they're, you know, should be no surprise to anybody that they're, you know, they're in part founded, I mean, funded by the likes of the Koch brothers and so forth.
Right.
Right. Naveed, do you have a question for Joe?
The one thing I wanted to focus on, not focus on, but the one observation I wanted to make is stand your ground. Well, first of all, Dr. Richardson, could you define what the stand your ground law is? For folks who aren't familiar with it?
Well, basically, the Stand Your Ground law is kind of the extension of the law that your castle is your domain, which specifically applied to you could, in some states, could use lethal force if you felt that your life was in danger if someone were to enter your home, right? So in states like Florida, they've actually extended the domain from your residence. And when I mean residence, I mean within your household, not outside of the door. So you couldn't chase someone outside of your home and, for instance, shoot them on your lawn, but within the domain of your house. So what the Stand Your Ground law has done is basically kind of taken your castle and your domain outside of the scope of your own home and extended that, particularly in a case in Florida, where your castle in your domain becomes anywhere where you feel threatened within the state of Florida. That could be within your home, on your lawn, on your block, on a street corner, or in a situation with Trayvon Martin in a gated community. So that's basically what the law has kind of supported now, and the domain and the level of fear that one could feel threatened is really subjective. So when they talk about, well, I felt fear, well, what does that actually mean? How do we quantify what a threat is? How do we manage to rationalize who feels threatened and who doesn't? What's very problematic with Stand Your Ground is that in all of the cases, the prosecutors really have their hands tied, because the person who would be able to kind of express the opposite side of what happened in that situation is no longer here to tell their story. So, for instance, the same situation with Trayvon Martin, he's no longer here to defend whether his domain was threatened or not. So we've heard discussions about Trayvon Martin was actually the person who was really supposed to be standing his ground in that case. But if we don't have his version of the story, which in the majority of cases where Stand Your Ground cases are brought to the courts, the prosecutors do not have the witness to defend the opposite side of the case. So what we have now is a law which basically justifies and condones that someone who feels threatened in a situation where they actually lethally and fatally kill someone is justifiable and they're able to walk away, because we don't have the victim to be able to defend themselves in that case.
Right. One observation I would like to make before going to a break right now is that basically Stand Your Ground is internationalizing Stand Your Ground. It's a pretty good definition of how the U.S. conducts foreign policy, actually, if you look at what the Stand Your Ground law is. Anyway, we have to go to a really quick break, and we'll be right back in a few minutes, and we'll be back with Joe and Solomon here on 1480 AM WEAC Radio, WPWC, on Your World News.
You're listening to WPWC WEAC Radio, 1480 AM, WEACradio.com.
Friends, David Schuster here, and all of us at WEAC Radio are so proud of our neighbors here in Southeast D.C., especially one of our partners, The Ark. The Ark is at 1901 Mississippi Avenue Southeast. It's the home to some of Washington's best, including the Washington Ballet, the Levine School of Music, Boys and Girls Club, and the Children's Health Project all provide a number of programs and services within the very same facility. The Ark is also home to the Ark Theater, the only theater east of the river, which hosts a variety of dance, music, and theatrical shows each year. Almost everything you could want is at the Ark, so stop by and see them. The Ark, 1901 Mississippi Avenue in Southeast. For more information, visit the Ark's website, www.thearkdc.org, or call 202-889-5901. The Ark, part of Southeast D.C.
Hello, this is Julia Louis-Dreyfus, and I want to tell you about my new favorite discovery, Yosemite National Park. I recently went there with my husband and children, and we walked the trails to see the breathtaking waterfalls, admired the grand meadows and giant sequoias. But the future of our national parks is uncertain. Many challenges face our parks today, from polluted air and water to development threats outside their borders and inadequate funding to protect our national heritage. That's why the National Parks Conservation Association recently completed a decade-long assessment of the challenges facing our national parks, along with proposed actions that will ensure our children and grandchildren will be able to enjoy the parks as we have. Our national parks have inspired Americans for nearly 100 years. As we approach the centennial of the National Park Service in 2016, please join us in helping to protect our national park legacy. Find out how at www.npca.org.
You're listening to WPWC WEAC Radio, 1480 AM, WEACradio.com.
Excuse me, everyone, I have a brief announcement to make. Jesus was black, Ronald Reagan was the devil, and the government is lying about 9/11. Thank you for your time, and good night.
And we're back on Your World News here on 1480 AM, WEAC Radio, WPWC. With me is my co-host, Solomon Kamishong, and our special guest, Joe Richardson. And I'll let you gentlemen take it away.
Joe, I wanted to ask you a question. Naveed and I, we started the show trying to connect the or paint a much broader context. As we know, in America, we, you know, from elementary school all the way to the rest of your life, if you have no intervention, you're programmed to see things as purely you know, black or white. I'm not talking about race, but just, you know, black or white, and in a very kind of linear kind of way, not looking at the broader context of things, whether it comes to history or law or social issues. And Joe, my question to you would be that would you see the murder of folks like Sean Bell, Oscar Grant, Amadou Diallo, you know, Trayvon Martin, Delonte Rollins, you know, Timothy Stansberry, Patrick Dorsman. Unfortunately,
right.
I can go on for, you know, a couple more hours, you know, listing names of black men who have been killed by the police or wannabe police. Would you see that as a part and parcel of policy that has been created in America where the browner you are, the darker you are, there's a unwritten rule that you know, those folks that look like you or I, or look like Trayvon Martin, or look like Sean Bell, you know, they are potentially
armed and dangerous. They need to be handled with extreme care, as if you're handling an explosive, and if need be disarm it, and in this case, and when I mean by disarm, I mean kill. You being someone that studies policy very intensely, would you see that as a policy, as reflective of the policy of policing in this country, these murders of black men?
Definitely. I mean, you have to think about the war on drugs and what the war on drugs has produced in devaluing of black life through policy and the mass incarceration policies we have. And I know we've had numerous discussions and have been inundated with statistics regarding the new Jim Crow and the prison industrial complex and the disproportionate number of African American and Latinos who have been incarcerated by way of over-policing and hyper-policing of communities within the context of poor communities in America. And what that means for African Americans and what that means in the devaluing of life through these policies. So clearly, the mass incarceration policies that we have, which subject primarily poor African American and Latinos to mass incarceration, and then the punishment that follows mass incarceration of having almost a scarlet letter for your entire life, which blocks you from all kinds of opportunities and disenfranchising a population of people from not being able to have the right to vote, to lack of access to housing, federal student loans, in essence making an entire population of people not even second or third class citizens, but basically just rendering them invisible. So if we think about those policies and what we've seen in the past, and we can think about we're coming up on the 20th anniversary of the Rodney King verdict. So if we think about that and just use that as a springboard for four officers who were basically allowed to just walk scot-free after being videotaped, almost beating to death a civilian, we've already set the standard for and the platform for how America is willing to condone the treatment of the disparate treatment of African Americans and Latinos. So I don't think it's any surprise that we have this system which starts out kind of criminalizing young African American and Latino, primarily boys, from the time that they're in school. I mean, we established that forecasting for prison beds is based on third grade reading levels. We know that. We know that there's a recent study just published by the Department of Labor which shows that one out of five African American boys has been suspended, right? That African American boys are disproportionately overrepresented among all young people who are suspended in schools. And it also leads back to even the Trayvon Martin case. And I think what some people are missing in this entire story, which I find to be really interesting, is that Trayvon Martin was actually suspended at the time that he was murdered. And he was suspended for having traces and whatever that, however the school tries to define traces, we still haven't had a clear explanation of what that means, right? But he was suspended for 10 days for having traces of marijuana in his bag. So getting back to the statistic that African-American boys are suspended at disproportionately higher rates than white males, I think it's almost 3.5 times higher, then we know that even in this case, Trayvon Martin was still subject to a zero-tolerance policy before the zero-tolerance policy of walking black in a neighborhood where he wasn't supposed, where he, according to George Zimmerman, wasn't supposed to be. So these zero-tolerance policies even existed well before the murder had taken place. Zero tolerance policies existed in Trayvon Martin's life when he was first suspended from school for that incident.
Mm-hmm.
So it almost amazes me that here's a case where a young man is suspended from school. If you think about it, 10 days, that's 2 weeks from school, where you have to bring in the issue with his parents. So during that time, we have thousands of kids across America, primarily African-American males, who have been suspended from school for the same reasons. Either they're pushed in the criminal juvenile justice system for suspension. There are no few schools which do suspensions within the school. So now you find this person that if it were not for his father, who I guess assume was accompanying him and was creating an environment where he was able to be supervised outside of being walking to the store that day, but had some sort of adult and parental supervision for him, he would have been left at home anyway, unsupervised, to freely walk around the neighborhood, to do whatever he wanted, because who cared about a life of Trayvon Martin? The school system definitely didn't, and neither did George Zimmerman. So you're looking at the combination of zero-tolerance policies in school, zero-tolerance policies for drugs, and the disproportionate number of people, young people who have been criminalized and pushed into the juvenile and criminal justice system, there's no question that, or no doubt that this country definitely cares very little about young African-American and Latino men.
I think one of the disgraceful things that has come about for me personally that I've witnessed in the aftermath of the Trayvon Martin incident is how he has been demonized because of precisely the things that you just talking about. He was suspended. Oh, he's a bad kid. He was suspended because he had some trace amount or whatever of marijuana in his backpack. Oh, he's a bad kid. They put all this stuff out there, and they made it really believable for a lot of folks when they turned it around and said, oh, he was assaulting George Zimmerman. There really is no evidence of that whatsoever, but because they had put all this stuff about there about him being suspended and him having X, you know, trace amount of marijuana in his backpack, for some reason that made it readily believable for a lot of folks that, yeah, this was a bad kid and he could easily have been the one who was actually assaulting George Zimmerman. And, oh, yeah, those tapes that we heard with that person screaming for help, that was actually George Zimmerman, and he was being assaulted, you know. So I mean, it's a catch 22. It really is. It's a catch 22. It's like you can't, like, you turn, you make a right turn and there's a dead end. You make a left turn and there's a dead end. You go straight and there's a dead end.
Right, and I just think it's almost just, it's incredulous how they've tried to use statements that he's made on Twitter as a proxy for his character. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe yesterday someone had asked me about this, make a statement about the Trayvon Martin case, and it was sent out on Twitter. And I stated this: if you were to examine the Twitter and Facebook and email accounts of most teenagers and adults in this country, I'm sure that you could pull things from anyone's Facebook or Twitter which people would find reprehensible and questionable about someone's character. So to take that from a 17-year-old boy's Twitter account and try to extrapolate from that this kid was some kind of delinquent young man who deserved to be murdered is just ridiculous. Also, we've totally now, because that dialogue has shifted to demonizing, and as the media will always do, and to some extent, well, demonizing Trayvon Martin, that we've totally forgotten about, A, these are the things that are factual. George Zimmerman was arrested for assaulting a police officer in 2005. He assaulted a police officer. Now, imagine if that was in Trayvon Martin's background. Yeah. Just picture that. Also, he made over 40 calls about suspicious people in his neighborhood, none of which resulted in an arrest. So if you have someone calling the police within a small period of time, and these are 46 calls, and none of them resulted in arrest, none of them resulted in someone being apprehended, statistically, even as a self-appointed person to a neighborhood watch, that to me is a direct indication of someone's incompetence. Because if I were a neighborhood watch and I had called the police 45 to 46 times about suspicious activity, and yet none of those calls produced an arrest, you have to begin to question what's the credibility of that person, mm-hmm. right? So I just think A, and no one is, and from my understanding, his father is a judge, which I recently heard. I don't know if that's factual or not, but if it is, it just even lends more suspicion to the case.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right, we need to go to a quick break right now, but we'll be back in a couple of minutes. You're listening to Your World News here on 1480 AM, WPWC WEAC Radio.
Breakdown with Richard Eskow airs every Saturday night from 7 to 9 p.m. on WEAC Radio, WPWC, 1480 AM, and WEACradio.com.
When people ask me what my show's about, what the premise is, I guess what they're asking is, what makes money, economics, finance interesting and exciting? How do they affect the things we see all around us, the events we read about or see on the news, the ups and downs of our own daily lives? What I tell them is this. If there were a magic ink that made the movement of money glow in the dark, if we could strip away the world around us and see the currents of that ink from somewhere in deep space, here's what we'd see. We'd see that all of it, the elections and coup d'etats, the rise and fall of nations and empires, the revolutions and wars and famines and riots, the sickness and health, the joblessness and wealth, the millions of human joys and sorrows that all of this creates, it would all look like the byproducts or side currents of that money as it flows in a great tidal wave. Even the things you don't think are affected by the flow. Oh, like fashion trends or prejudices or the latest pop music, all of it turns out to be the eddies and currents of that giant flow. Is reality really that simple? Probably not, but it's pretty close. And on one level, the level that a lot of power players operate on, that is the reality. You've seen our world, but we'll show you our world on Monday. I'm Richard Eskow, and this is The Breakdown.
You're listening to WPWC WEAC Radio, 1480 AM, WEACradio.com.
Back now with Your World News here on WEAC Radio, 1480 AM, WPWC. With us is my co-host Solomon Kamishong. And our special guest, Joe Richardson. My name is Naveed Nasser. Solomon, you were getting ready to say something just before we went to the break.
Yeah, I was. I was about to say something and to ask Joe a question.
Mm-hmm.
Joe, you know, one of the laughable things, and Naveed as well, we were just talking about this yesterday,
mm-hmm.
the laughable things is that it seems like, you know, supporters of Obama, you know, they will go out of their way, you know, to believe anything about their messiah. They, you know, he could be committing the same exact crimes as his dim-witted predecessor, George Bush, and he's doing so much of what his predecessor, George Bush, is doing, and even has taken it up a notch. And, you know, yet these folks continue to support him. And you know, and so, you know, when Obama, you know, said that, you know, if he had a son, he would look like Trayvon Martin, you know, these, like, just frenzied Obama supporters and the cult that is Obama, they were like, oh, see, yeah, such and such. And I'm like, well, first and foremost, you know, he didn't connect what happened to Trayvon Martin to institutional racism or racial profile in any shape, form, or fashion. But let's get to something even more substantive. In 2008, it was candidate Barack Obama that not even in essence, I mean, blatantly, you know, condone the acquittal of the police officers, the multiple police officers that shot Sean Bell 40 plus times, you know, 12 hours, you know, before he was to be married, you know, an unarmed black man in Queens, New York. And Obama, you know, said that this is a nation of just laws and that we need to respect the ruling of the verdict of the judge who just acquitted Arthur Krupperman, who just acquitted the police murders of Sean Bell. And so, you know, this whole illusion that Obama has consistently been some kind of ally against in the struggle against police brutality and police murder is a farce. It's false. It's phony. And so, Joe, you know, as I said, that Obama has been doing much of the same things that his predecessor has done. You know, his supporters are just, and I just that's a whole nother show that we'll do sometimes. You know,
right?
But they're delusional. They're delusional, and I would say that they don't believe in justice themselves, because you know, anytime you can condone, you know, wars, imperialist wars in Libya and other places, simply because this is your man, you don't believe in justice. But Joe, I want to ask you about something that Bush enacted, and that Obama has gone ahead and supported himself. You know, something that a lot of people don't know about. And can you explain what this is, the Byrne Act? Why this is an affront on black and brown communities? In our struggle, you know, to against the prison industrial complex, what is the Byrne Act? How has Obama supported it? And what are your personal views on it?
So the Byrne Act was created as part of the propaganda for the war on drugs, and I don't want to make insignificant the death of a police officer or death of anyone, because the act is actually named after a police officer who was killed while serving as an officer in a drug case where he was protecting a witness in a drug trial, and he was killed in the line of duty. So the actual law, the Byrne Act, was named after this officer. The law was intended to provide more money to increase the level of policing in urban communities, which in turn would fuel the prison industrial complex. So in the same way that kind of Bush supported this act, and then Bill Clinton during the Clinton years, and we kind of fall all over Bill Clinton and have anointed him as the first black president, even before we actually have the president we have now, Barack Obama. Bill Clinton also, in his desire to appear as tough on crime, not only engaged in supporting the execution and supporting death penalty laws, but also had signed an acts as well, which brought more police into urban America. I think almost like 100,000. He signed funding to bring 100,000 more police officers into urban communities, which under his administration and under his regime, the prison industrial complex boomed. So more African Americans were arrested, incarcerated under Bill Clinton than any other presidential administration in American history. Not too many people know that. But Barack Obama, in the same vein as Bill Clinton, almost kind of a wolves in sheep's clothing, has signed and supported the Byrne Act. So Michelle Alexander talks about it extensively in The New Jim Crow, that Barack Obama is also a supporter of the prison industrial complex in the same way that he's a supporter of the military industrial complex. Barack Obama has also supported the Byrne Act, which calls for providing more police on the streets, which in essence would lead to the building of more prisons.
Mm-hmm. I mean, what I would like to say is it's not even so much that they're wolves in sheep's clothing. People project a lot. when they see these figures that are supposedly on their side, whether it's Barack Obama, whether it's Bill Clinton, whether it's Al Gore, people genuinely want to believe it, and they don't look into what they're doing. The other thing that the Clinton administration did that a lot of people probably aren't aware of is he built more federal prisons than any other president since, and he instituted the three strikes and you're outlaws in most of the country. So, I mean, these are some of the things that need to be...
He also put in place laws which would permanently ban convicted drug felons from public housing. So there are a whole lot of laws that were created under the Clinton administration which were used to promote and fuel the prison industrial complex. But as people of color, we're so easy not to really go beyond what we see superficially and kind of play personality politics in the same way that we're playing them with Barack Obama. If we have Bill Clinton, if he's able to go on Arsenio Hall and wear some sunglasses and play the sax, then that's just okay for black people. In the same way Barack Obama is able to walk up into a black church, typically around election time, and then can try to persuade African Americans that he's been totally supportive of them from the outset of being elected, it's just false. And I guess another thing I don't want to be remiss to say with Barack Obama as well is that I don't hear the conversation of personal responsibility outside of the context of speaking to African Americans. Mm-hmm. There have been so many times that I've heard that the context of fatherhood and responsible fatherhood, and I'm not negating that all fathers across race need to be responsible, but I think that he needs to have much more of an even discussion about what personal responsibility really means before trying to lay that in the hands of black people. But then when he's speaking to the mainstream, the criticism is about the inequality and ineffectiveness of the structure. So I don't understand why there becomes an issue of, well, the structure has seemed to fail the mainstream, but when the African Americans, who have been failed by the structure more than any other group in the United States, the discussion becomes one about cultural responsibility. So, again, I mean, we're going back playing this record and this tape over and over, where we have just kind of blindly committed our support to a candidate without really understanding what impact he's had on the destruction of African Americans and particularly poor African American communities.
Right. For someone who's supposed to be the president of the people, he does a lot of finger wagging and a lot of it's your fault, you need to take responsibility, a lot of Bill Cosby-esque rhetoric.
Right.
When he's addressing the African American community. We have a short amount of time left, a minute. Salman, would you like to take us out? Some closing thoughts?
Yeah, I just want to, once again, as I open up, you know, thank you, Naveed, and thank We Act Radio, and thank our guest, you know, Dr. Joseph Richardson for coming on the show. But more importantly than him coming on the show, I want to thank Joe for the, you know, continued good work that he does in the community.
Absolutely.
And, you know, like I said, most professors on elite campuses such as University of Maryland, Georgetown, et cetera, you know, when they teach about criminal justice system, they teach about it from an approach that, you know, supports, you know, war on drugs, war on black and brown people. Joe is one of those professors that, that, you know, teaches from another perspective, and he buttresses everything with facts and data that makes it doubly, you know, difficult for anyone to deny, but most importantly, it allows students to be exposed to information that they're not typically exposed to, and so that they can democratically, you know, draw the lines in terms of justice and social justice, and seeing that the way policing and incarceration is done in this country is about as backwards as one can possibly get.
Right. Yeah, so anyway, we need to wrap up this episode of Your World News. I'd like to thank you all for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Salman Kamishong, my name is Naveed Nasser, and we'll be back next week, Friday, 11 a.m., right here on WEAC Radio, 1480 a.m., WPWC.
another way. A letter from the government the other day. I opened and read it and heard that. Man, it's the way that I live, don't concern that. Man, we gon' have to settle this another way.
Movement, music, move into it. Put a fist up, prove it to us. This is much more than music to us. This is beauty and strength. And if you know about the music, then you know about life. This is movement, music, move into it. Put a fist up, prove it to us. This is much more than music to us. This is beauty and strength. And if you know about the music, then you know about life.
Word is
any kind of activity that takes place on the floor of the Congress or the Senate, that's the government. Any kind of dilly-dallying, that's the government. Any kind of pussyfooting, that's the government. Any kind of act that's designed to delay, or deprive you and me right now of getting full rights, that's the government that's responsible. And any time you find the government involved in a conspiracy,
no return, I can never go back. Life without parole, upstate, shackled and trapped. Living in the hole, looking at the world through a crack. Hope that I'd rather shoot it out than get clapped.